Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Coming up on today's broadcast, musical notes for the presentation in the temple. But first, what drives an abbot? A peek at consecrated life. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. Today I'd like to focus my attention, as I mentioned a second ago, on consecrated life by painting for you a sound picture of a man who decided at one point to change his lifestyle, becoming a Benedictine monk. Where? Well, in England. His monastery of profession, Dalwhey Abbey near Reading. Since then, he's become an abbot, a word which, as you know, comes from the word Abba, meaning father. But before I tell you more about him and his role as father of a community, what abbey he's abbot of, and indeed who he is, let's listen for a moment to some snippets from an interview he granted me, in which he graciously tells me a little bit about himself, beginning with the vows he once took and what they mean to him now as an abbot of a community. Vows of stability, conversion of life, and obedience.
Some people might think that an abbot has abandoned obedience because everybody has to do what he says. There's a lot of images of this stability. One image that I like is that of the Blessed Virgin at the foot of the cross, you know, the great hymn, Stabat Mater. The conversion of life, we don't usually translate in Latin, it's conversatio morum, it's an ancient idea of gradually transforming one's lifestyle. Benedict says that the things that a monk should have are very few, but among those which he lists is a stylus. Well, what does that mean today? Does it mean every monk has to carry a biro with him?
What does an abbot read apart from St. Benedict?
Well, of course, Shakespeare. Who else is there? No, Jane Austen's pretty good as well.
The harmonious tones of the voice of the abbot in question. The abbot of St. Paul's outside the walls here in Rome, his name Edmund Power. I met him in one of the many waiting rooms within the compound adjacent to this basilica that seemed removed from time, despite being in the heart of Rome. Well, I'd met abbots before. They'd been familiar to me ever since I was little, and I'd even worked with one for many years here at the radio. But still, I was daunted by the idea of meeting another. Particularly as all I knew about him was that he'd previously been prior of the International Academic Community of Study at St. Anselmo on Rome's Aventine Hill. And those words, academic, study, had conjured up for me the image of an intellectual, whatever that means. But when he appeared announced by the swish of his flowing black Benedictine robes, I realised I was wrong. This wasn't just an intellectual. He had charisma to sell as well. So you two can picture him. I'll attempt to describe the man who stood before me. A character that seemed to have stepped out of the mists of time. A medieval monk and Sean Connery look-alike all in one. Oh dear, I thought. Daunting, I was right. But I needn't have worried. Benedictines are by definition always welcoming. And he was too. Even when encountering an inquisitive journalist who wished to pry into his personal life, recording his every word. I began by asking him if there were an added title to him beyond that of the Abbot of St. Paul's outside the walls.
An added title, title enough, I think. No, Abbot of St. Paul's. In the past, the Abbot of St. Paul's was a major prelate in the sense that the abbey was a so-called territorial abbey, which ranked as a diocese. But nowadays, it's just a simple, innocent, ordinary abbey.
Well, I think it's a bit much to say that, considering it's where St. Paul is buried. It has a lot of history connected to it. When it was razed to the ground, there were all kinds of people vying to embellish the church, like the Russian Tsar, who was Orthodox, and even Islam contributed via Egypt to the embellishment of the church. John the 23rd called the Second Vatican Council in St. Paul's Basilica. And in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council became a great symbol of Christian unity. So I don't think it's an ordinary church, is it?
No, I'm being a little ironic, I suppose. In fact, the history is long and very interesting and goes back well before the Benedictines, because St. Paul died maybe 65 AD. The Benedictine community was clearly installed by about the year 720, but there was a lot going on here in the Basilica before that. You mentioned some of the points of the history of the Basilica, including, for example, the proclamation of the Vatican Council, but we take some pride in the fact that Pope John XXIII didn't, in fact, proclaim the council in the Basilica, but in the abbot's apartment in the monastery. Yes, the Benedictine monks of St. Paul's have been closely associated with the Basilica and its work and its life, and the care of the memory of St. Paul the Apostle for 1,300 years and more now.
It's a strange kind of monastery. You think of monasteries as being on top of a hill in the silence with liturgical celebrations going on, whereas you're right in the heart of Rome. What does an abbot actually do here? Is there something different in what an abbot does within a community like this, or is he the same abbot everywhere?
Well, the role of the abbot is essentially the same everywhere, and it's fairly clearly defined within the Rule of St. Benedict, written in the 6th century. The image of monasteries as being in the middle of nowhere, in fact, is a sort of fantasy, really, because they may have started off in distant places, but very rapidly populations gathered around them because they were centres of economy and of work and of organisation. So very few of the great monasteries are very isolated nowadays. Some are, of course, like Subiaco, which is still up in the mountains. St. Paul's, in fact, when it was founded, was way out of the city, a couple of miles from the walls, and until the last 50 years was essentially isolated in the countryside. But the city has caught up now, so we're not on a hill, we're down in the river mud. But because of St. Paul, here we are, and the world has come to us.
So St. Benedict started out as a hermit in Subiaco, but he also founded the monastic, I don't know if you can call it a movement. So in a sense, you're running monasteries, which are rather elitish, as abbots of Benedictine communities.
Well, I don't know if I describe it quite like that. St. Benedict certainly had no intention of founding a movement. The idea of a movement is a way of describing something in retrospect through the eyes of historians. There's certainly no sense of movement at the time. It's true, St. Benedict went to seek God in the tranquility and solitude of Subiaco. He had no intention of doing anything other than that. But people willy-nilly came to him and seeking his help or his guidance. And gradually he was compelled, I suppose, to organise communities because of people coming to him. Then the movement to Monte Cassino wasn't an idea of founding something that would go on in history. He went to that rather isolated place and a new community began around him. When he died, he had no idea, probably, what history would hold. But in fact, the livability of the Rule of St. Benedict, it's a very practical document, both spiritual and functional, meant that it became inspiration for a lot of Christian life within the West ever since. Monasticism existed before Benedict, in fact. He wasn't the creator of monasticism, but he can be placed within a tradition that predates him. It was originally not elitist at all, really. It was a lay protest movement against, I suppose, the affluence of the city, against clericalism. But gradually the monasteries evolved their own life. And naturally, if groups come together with a common purpose, then they often do become wealthy in the sense of developing the land, people give them things, and they became great centres of employment, culture, work, to the enormous benefit of the people around them, in fact.
Talking about the people around you, when you were first drawn to the Benedictine life, couldn't you have chosen the Franciscan life? What drew you to Benedictine life?
I didn't know any Franciscans. I think a lot does depend on circumstance. And I got to know Benedictines. And as a result of that, my path led me to join a Benedictine community.
I know that Benedictines make vow of stability, obedience and conversion. I don't know that I got that in the right order.
Yes, we predate canon law in a way, because St. Benedict died in 547. The drawing up of canon law and the concept of religious vows was much, much later. For him, the monastic profession was a single dedication. with different aspects. It was later that it was divided into three vows, which are stability, conversion of life and obedience, which include the so-called evangelical councils, poverty, chastity and obedience, which most religious take as their, inverted commas, vows nowadays.
Can I ask you a personal question? What vow did you find most difficult and which did you find easiest?
Do you mean then or now?
Well, that's an interesting one. Then and now.
Then and now. Well, it's very difficult to answer the then because we're looking back over a period of 35 years. It's difficult to say. In youthful enthusiasm, you enter and you throw yourself into things. I don't know. I don't think any of them were particularly more difficult than any other. Stability, for example, has got different senses. It's a very rich idea. On one level, it means belonging to the single community in which you profess your life and belonging to that community until you die. It's a particular Benedictine thing. It is strange that I'm here as Abbot of St. Paul's when, in fact, my monastery of profession is in England. Stability also includes not just belonging physically to a community, but also it means stability in the sense of a fundamental, reliable, persevering dedication to the relationships of life within the community, you know, being faithful to one's confreres, but also being faithful to the search for God. There's a lot of images of this stability. One image that I like is that of Blessed Virgin at the foot of the cross, you know, the great hymn Stabat Mater, the word Stabat meaning she was standing. And the idea of standing stably, not running away in the face of great suffering. The word stability comes from the word stare, to stand, to remain firm. So there are different spiritual aspects to this as well. The conversion of life, which we don't usually translate in Latin, it's conversatio morum, it's an ancient idea of gradually transforming one's lifestyle into the lifestyle of the monastic search for God, which includes various aspects of asceticism. It includes, for example, chastity or celibacy. It includes a certain discipline of the rhythm of the day. It includes prayer. It includes a certain element of silence and solitude. It includes the dedication to the study and reading prayerfully of the scriptures and so on. And then obedience, well, obedience is a relationship, essentially. It's a reflection of Christ's obedience to the Father, but concretely, it's a relationship of mutual responsibility and trust within the framework of community. Some people might think that an abbot has abandoned obedience because everybody has to do what he says. But in fact, most abbots find that the burden of obedience is far heavier on them than it ever was before they were abbot. Obedience means living with responsibility, and each monk has to learn how to do that. And when the abbot is thrust into the position of abbot, the responsibility is even greater, so the obedience is greater.
What are the great qualities of an abbot who knows how to lead his community? I mean, communities are difficult places, aren't they? You have positive aspects, like, you know, the joy of living together, the stability, as you mentioned, and perhaps there are all the negative aspects, the so-called misery of living in communities. You know? I would identify envy as being one of the horrible things. What do you aspire to as qualities as an abbot? You must put a lot of thought into that, no?
Well, what would I look for in an abbot is one question. It would be more interesting to ask the monks of the community how they view their abbot or what they look for in an abbot. St. Benedict describes the abbot in a number of ways. For example, the abbot has to be even-handed to avoid favouritism. Treat all with respect. He can't, St. Benedict doesn't say this, but it's implied, the abbot can't lose his temper at a monk. I think a certain sort of stability of approach to people is very important. But there are qualities which you might grace them with spiritual names, like wisdom, the spirit of wisdom. But in fact, common sense, I think, is essential in any superior. And compassion or love, I said, call that kindness, or just dealing with people in a respectful way. I mean, a lot of the kind of highfalutin way of describing the life of an abbot just boils down to basic knowing how to deal with people, how to bring out the best in people. You're right, envy. I don't think there's any more envy in a monastery than in any other angle of the world. I don't think there's any more envy in a monk than in any other person. I think we're talking of perennial challenges throughout the human race, you know, dealing with our basic selfishness. Not that we're all fundamentally selfish necessarily, but we all have to battle with the tendency to selfishness, to serve our own purposes, to abandon difficult relationships or decisions, to look for the easy way out. I mean, that's part of the human challenge, and it's just as real in a monastery as outside a monastery. But maybe, I don't know, if monks are more explicitly or clearly trying to face this challenge, I hope they are. But fundamentally, of course, we're all searching for God, all the monks. That's why they're here. There's no other reason really to be here. And when you look round at the motley gathering in the community, they're not people you'd naturally probably choose to live with if you wanted to share a life with somebody on a natural level. They're not necessarily the people who share your interests or your background or your culture. But it's a great demonstration, I think, of what St. Paul says. Well, he says there's no longer Jew nor Greek, there's no longer slave nor free. In other words, everybody united in the common search, in this particular way of searching for God, finds an identity, a common identity, which enables them to live together with charity. And in fact, living with the people that you're compelled to live with is an excellent way of overcoming selfishness. You know, if you put a whole a cup full of rough stones together and shake them enough, they gradually smooth off and become nice pebbles.
Does an abbot have to be a good listener?
Yes. That doesn't mean I necessarily am, but yes. In fact, the very first word of the rule of St. Benedict is the command to listen. He starts the rule, "Listen, my son, to the teachings of the Master, and incline the ear of your heart." And the theme of listening runs through the rule. Benedict isn't thinking just of monks sitting down in a military style and responding to what the abbot tells them to do. He's thinking of the more fundamental obedience to the word of God, listening to the word of God in prayer, the divine office, in Lectio Divina, which is the prayerful reading of the scriptures. Through that listening, one's heart is expanded. The listening extends beyond the scriptures. It touches also one's brothers or sisters in community. And then beyond that, the needs of the poor, the world around, people who come to the monastery, the guests, the pilgrims, and so on. So the process of listening is a fundamental process, fundamental within the monastic vision, fundamental within the Benedictine vision. And therefore, I would say, all the more the abbot needs to be able to listen to what his monks are saying to him.
You quote from St. Benedict's rule. Benedict wrote the rule in Monte Cassino, no? Over a millennium and a half ago. Wouldn't you throw anything out?
Throw anything out? Yeah, I would. I'd throw out the reference to the infrequency of bathing, for example. The references to corporal punishment. But the importance of the rule is its broad spiritual vision. Nearly all of its spiritual teaching is completely perennial. It's relevant today equally as it was then. But St. Benedict had a fine insight into the way human beings operate, the way relationships are played out, and his advice is living and real today. But a few of the details, of course, you have to just overlook them or reinterpret them. I'll give you an example. Benedict says that the things that a monk should have are very few, but among those which he lists is a stylus. Now, a stylus was a kind of a 5th century pen with which people wrote. Well, what does that mean today? Does it mean every monk has to carry a biro with him? No, I think it means that if a monk needs to use a computer, for example, a word processor, that's the equivalent today. So people who say monks shouldn't have computers, St. Benedict wouldn't have allowed it, I think they're wrong. I think Benedict would have allowed it.
I'd like to play in the factor that St. Benedict is also patron saint of Europe. What works best across cultural divides in monastic communities? St. Benedict's rule?
The rule of St. Benedict, although Benedict was declared by Paul VI 40 years ago, just over 40 years ago, patron of Europe, the first patron of Europe, that was for historical, cultural and spiritual reasons. I mean, he made the continent. And it's quite clear that even some political institutions, ways of looking at things, depend very much on the influence of the Benedictine rule. You could say the concept of the European community is a Benedictine concept. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it had a huge influence on the development of Europe. That's why he was declared patron of Europe. But it doesn't mean that it was restricted to Europe. In fact, there are monasteries throughout the world in every culture.
If I told you I thought I had a vocation for Benedictine community, would you tell me to read St. Benedict?
I would say the first thing to do would be to visit a Benedictine community and stay with them for a while, and then start to read the rule.
What does an abbot read apart from St. Benedict?
Novels.
Like modern novels? Or?
No, I read a whole lot of stuff. I taught English literature for years, so I'm very fond of all the great classics of English literature. And I read them very happily. But
your favourite?
Well, of course, Shakespeare. Who else is there? No, Jane Austen's pretty good as well. No, but I've got a whole lot of favourites. Keats, who's buried close to here, in fact, by the pyramid. I go on pilgrimage there occasionally. No, those things. But also, I quite like fantasy novels. I've become more impatient as the years have gone by of bad style, but I find it quite diverting. And I think the fantasy literature, in fact, is quite interesting nowadays with its moral and metaphysical dimensions. You know, it's a sort of, you could say, it's a leading in to the great mysteries of life.
And you're more serious needing to end on a serious note?
My more serious reading? Well, my more serious reading, I have to say, and this is just what you'd expect, would be the Bible, of course. We have to spend so much time reading the Bible as Lectio Divina, prepare for homilies, prepare for talks, that really is the literature that runs through the veins of the monk. You know, this is the fundamental formative, this is the language of the heart. And it's been a big influence also on Western literature. So reading Western literature, you're not all that far from the Bible.
My thanks there go to the Abbot of St. Paul's Outside the Walls, Edmund Power, for offering us this inspiring and honest insight into consecrated life, and on a more personal note, for being so patient with me. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to end on a reflective note by sharing with you a musical comment on the fourth joyful mystery of the Rosary, the presentation in the temple. So stay tuned and join our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Mary and Joseph came to the temple to present the child Jesus to the Lord, as the law required. The presentation in the temple is the fourth joyful mystery of the Rosary. We celebrate it liturgically 40 days after Christmas on the Feast of Candlemas, when we process with lighted candles, bearing witness before the world to the light of Christ. In fact, Simeon describes Jesus as lumen ad revelationem gentium, a light to enlighten the Gentiles.
Lumen ad revelationem gentium, et gloriam plebis tuae Israel.
For our musical meditation today, I'd like to focus on the figure of Simeon. He is presented to us as an old man, devout and upright, faithful to the traditions of Israel. He's one of those pivotal figures between the Old and New Testaments. For most of his life, he was waiting for the Messiah to come. But at the end of his life, he had the privilege of seeing for himself the one who would bring salvation to his people. Senex puerum portabat, the old man carried the child, yet the child was the old man's king. Setting of the Magnificat antiphon for First Vespers on the Feast of the Presentation was composed by William Byrd, a Catholic composer in the reign of Elizabeth I. It's included in a large collection of music that he wrote for use in Catholic worship behind closed doors in the homes of the aristocracy, because Catholic worship in England at that time was strictly against the law of the land. William Byrd enjoyed special favour with Queen Elizabeth, who knew a good composer when she heard one. Although he was a Catholic, he was employed to write music for the Chapel Royal for much of his life. Not only did the Queen apparently not mind him being a Catholic, but there is evidence that she privately paid him an allowance to help him meet the cost of the fines he incurred as a result. He returned the compliment by composing the most glorious music for the liturgy of the Chapel Royal. Listening to the Nunc Dimittis from Byrd's Great Service. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word. This is the third of the great gospel canticles that form part of the daily liturgy of the hours, and St. Luke places it on the lips of Simeon during the scene of the presentation of the Lord in the temple. It's a marvellous prayer. Simeon acknowledges the privilege he has been given, and he speaks prophetically of the light that Jesus will bring to all the nations of the world. To finish with a more modern setting of the Nunc Dimittis. It was written by Gustav Holst for the choir of Westminster Cathedral in 1915. Listen to the energy of those repeated phrases, Lumen ad Revelationem Gentium, and the exaltation of the concluding Et Gloriam Plebis Tuae Israel. With joy let us contemplate the infant Jesus, who is indeed the light to enlighten the Gentiles, and the glory of his people Israel.
Heartfelt thanks there once again to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who is currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.